Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Okay, hi everybody. Welcome to the future of publishing. And I love that the publishing panel has this cozy couch, because we are so cozy. And this is a super exciting panel this year, actually, because we have representation from what I see as the four major divisions of publishing. And so we'll talk about that when we introduce everybody. I am going to just go down the row here and say who everybody is, and then they'll talk more about their experiences as I unpack the questions. So we'll start with Avalon here, closest to me. Avalon Radis is Director of Publishing Operations and Marketing at Inkshares, a book publishing and literary rights management company based in Oakland. In early 2006, she led the effort to bring book production in-house, managing teams in editorial design, printing, and marketing. In her 3 years at Inkshares, Avalon has shepherded nearly 100 books across 5 imprints through the publication process, many of which are now in development for TV and film. Inkshares' first television series adaptation, The Show, a timely series about the destructive force of a data-hungry AI program that can predict human behavior, debuted on April 23rd of this year. Sounds awesome. Next to her is Niels Hooper, executive editor at UC Press since 2004, was previously general manager of Verso Books in New York. Driven by a desire to learn from historic struggles and overcome injustices, he has cultivated a list that constantly interrogates power and explores past possibilities for a more just society. Some highlights from his program include Rebecca Solnit's Atlas Trilogy, Grace Lee Boggs' The Next American Revolution, Joshua Bloom and Waldo Martin's Black Against Empire, Laura Briggs' How All Politics Became Reproductive Politics, Salem Tamari's The Great War and Remaking of Palestine, and Martin Duberman's Has the Gay Movement Failed? Thanks, Niels. Next to him is Emily Bell. Emily Bell is a beloved senior editor at Farrar, Straus & Giroux and is the director in charge of FSG Originals, a division of the publishing company that strives to scout and publish authors who defy categorization. She publishes women such as Lucia Berlin, Amelia Gray, Lindsay Hunter, Catherine Lacey, and Laura Vandenberg. She began her career nurturing writers at Riverhead Books. And last in line is Elaine Katzenberger. So happy that you made it, Elaine. Hi. is the executive director and publisher at City Lights Booksellers and Publishers and the program director for the City Lights Foundation. She has edited many works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry, and her books have received numerous prizes and awards, and she lives in San Francisco. And I am Brooke Warner. I am the publisher of She Writes Press, and I am thrilled to be here to moderate this panel. And so the four main areas of publishing that we're talking about today is starting with Elaine. We have small press publishing, and everyone, I hope, knows City Lights as it's a legacy and institution in San Francisco, and we'll talk about small press publishing. Emily represents one of the big five publishers with FSG, part of Macmillan. Niels is here on behalf of University Presses, which has a whole other way of looking at the publishing industry, and I'm excited to talk about that. And then Avalon's publishing company, Inkshares, is a non-traditional and interesting model, kind of an experimental model that we'll talk about a bit. And what we see emerging in publishing right now are a lot of indie presses that are redefining how publishing is doing what it's doing. And my own press, She Writes Press, also falls into that model of non-traditional publishing. We call ourselves a hybrid publisher. So thank you all for being here, and thank you to this audience. I love how many people are interested in publishing, what the future of publishing might bring, and really looking forward to hearing what all of these superstars of the publishing industry have to tell us about what is up. So let's start with Emily. FSG is part of Macmillan, as I just said, a Big Five publisher. What do you think the Big Five means to authors today? And why is one or some, or sorry, what is one or some of the biggest challenges larger publishers face in today's ever diversifying publishing climate?
That is a really long question. I think that you know, a lot of sort of emerging writers think that if you're going to be published, you have to be published by one of the big five, and you have these kind of big dreams and ambitions. I don't think that's necessarily like going to be the best path for everybody, especially with their first book. One of the challenges of the big five is that we publish a lot of books, I think too many, which I shouldn't say to writers, but you want to make sure you're at a house where you're getting the kind of like attention and representation you should be getting, and you have the kind of personal connections. And I think that, you know, I try to keep my own list pretty small. I publish 10 to 12 books a year. Any more than that, I wouldn't be able to give the author, you know, what they need. And so, yeah, I think that's one of the more difficult things, is that there's a pressure to publish more, and there aren't the resources to give authors what they need.
And is that 10 to 12 on this FSG Originals, or just what you bring in for the whole program?
Yeah, I publish. I acquire for FSG, FSG Originals, and a new imprint called MCD. So it's across those three imprints, okay. And pretty evenly distributed. I like it to be that way. So
okay, fabulous. Thank you, Elaine. As I said, City Lights is an institution in San Francisco with such an important history and legacy. What is the highlight of being there, and how conscious of that history are you when you're thinking about what you bring in and what you sell? Sorry, everybody has their own microphone in those pretty little boxes if you want to go ahead and grab those presents.
I have dueling microphones. What's the best part about being there? Is that what you said?
What's the best part, and how conscious of the history are you in terms of your acquisition and selling thought process?
Well, I'm always conscious of the history of City Lights. The history of City Lights informs the present of City Lights, and that's always been true.
Maybe talk closer to the mic.
Is that better? Yeah. Okay. Sorry. City Lights is 63 years old now as a publisher. The bookstore was founded first in 1953, and then the publishing house in 55. And we do have a storied past, obviously, but then, you know, it's been 60-something years, and we wouldn't be around if that's all we had done. There's a set of ideals and principles that are embedded into the history of City Lights that have been carried forward ever since. And I think that those kinds of intangibles are what have always informed anything that we do in that institution. Otherwise, it wouldn't be what it is. It would be something else. So everything that I do is reflective of the core sort of historical and contemporary, always made new. Every decade, there's another manifestation of what it meant to publish some of those books that people think about, like Howl or Standing Up for Free Expression, and all the kinds of things that, you know, maybe people think about beatniks and those values. But it never stopped there. So there's been examples in the publishing program at City Lights continuously all the way through. That said, it's not just a political place. It's a press that was founded by a poet. Poetry is a big part of what we do and always will be. The commitment and understanding that creativity can influence civic life in a positive and powerful way, and that it's incredibly important for a democratic society to function, to create a space for creative thinking and magical thinking and fantastic thinking and outrageous thinking. So, I mean, there's kind of no being at City Lights without being soaked in that all the time. So,
and is small press an adequate identifier for you?
It's interesting that you use the term that mm-hmm. way, and you use the term indie for what mm-hmm. you're doing, because we have always referred to ourselves as an independent press,
right,
as opposed to a corporate-owned press. I don't think of us as small, But I suppose compared to FSG or Macmillan or one of those, we're small. But I think of small press as like one or two books a year. Okay. City Lights publishes 16 to 20 books a year and has consistently been doing that. But I do think that, yes, in the scale of us versus a press that's doing 50, 100, 200 titles a year, yeah, we're small in that regard. But well, I don't think of us as a small
press. And it's an interesting conversation maybe about, which we could get into in the Q&A, about whether non-traditional models have co-opted the term indie, which I kind of think has happened, but that's we'll talk about it more later. But you're an original indie.
I think she might be the original indie.
Perfect. Thank you. All right. Niels, I'd like to hear about university publishing programs and what they're doing these days. I think one of the challenges academic presses face is around financing book projects, and yet I just read off the series of pretty amazing roster of authors, of course. And then there's also speed to market, and I think I've noticed anyway that academic presses seem to have problems with price points. So are these challenges that you see press faces, and if so, how do you see those challenges?
That's loud.
No, you're good. Bring it
that's
on.
That's good, like that. Yeah. I think it's I would say that there's a big diversity between university presses, for everything from Oxford University Press, which is basically a global conglomerate, one of the largest publishers in the world, to tiny university presses that have three or four people in a university library. The University of California Press is one of the six largest in the country. We are actually 125 years old this year. We do about 200 books a year, and we're in the league with like Chicago and Yale and Harvard and Princeton. And the questions you asked about the price point and speed to market refer to sort of one segment of our publishing program, which is the scholarly segment. And if we're publishing niche scholarly books that are very dense, that are intended for a couple of hundred scholars and libraries, then the price point has to be high because we're only printing about 500 copies of those. But when we're publishing trade books, which we do, which is about 20 to 30% of our list, or books for the classroom, we publish those like any other publisher. As I mentioned, Rebecca Solnit's atlases. So these are $29.95, so it's an affordable price. And I've done a series of short books, which are sort of guides to key current affairs issues, which are about $15. And these come out in 5 months. So that's as fast as pretty much any responsible publisher can do it. So I think Vanity Fair has a 3-month lead time. So it's I think it just depends on the types of books that we do. And all scholarly publishers have been sort of under pressure over the last 20 years to diversify their lists, not to just do scholarly books, in order to cover the costs, the financing of. So we do trade books and course books that still fulfill our mission, a public mission, to cover the costs of scholarly books.
Okay, thank you. So Avalon, this kind of goes into this conversation about terms, how we self-identify as different presses. I think of Inkshares as, we'll say, new indie. So because you have a non-traditional business model, it centers around crowdfunding. I thought it would be helpful if you could tell the audience a little bit about that model, why you think Inkshares is growing, and maybe also just more broadly why non-traditional models are increasingly attracting authors.
Definitely. So Inkshares has been around for about 5 years, and we've undergone a few evolutions to our model, given the things that we've tested and what we've seen has worked and whatnot. So up until about a year and a half ago, we did greenlight books for publishing solely on the basis of pre-order numbers on our platform. So we have about 100,000 authors and readers on Inkshares.com that essentially, if they're an author, they come to us and they put up a partial manuscript to see if they can earn enough pre-orders so that we'll publish them. So in the beginning, we saw some success with this. So some of our books went on to sell tens of thousands of copies in the broader market, which was really exciting. And as she mentioned earlier, we've had some success in TV and film adaptations. But what we saw in the last few years is that some really incredible manuscripts would come onto Inkshares, but they would fail to garner significant pre-orders because the authors, you know, were writers first and foremost, and they didn't have a skill set in terms of crowdfunding and marketing themselves. So even though pre-orders are still sort of a mainstay of our business model, we found that in order to maximally leverage this growing community of authors and readers on the platform to help bubble up more interesting stories that people care about, it was important to sort of expand the indicators that we looked at to determine what we would publish. So we kind of refer to them internally as soft engagement. They're non-monetary metrics that we look at. So these are things like the time that people spend reading and engaging with a book on the platform, the amount of shares and follows it accumulates. So we now surface stories on this basis in a manner that's parallel to pre-orders. So we sort of have both of those models working together. And what we've found is that we've been able to build a much stronger recommendation algorithm so that we can better match readers on the platform with stories that they'll be interested in, or new authors with more seasoned authors, so that they can kind of help each other, and also to rights buyers, because we have quite a few agents and other rights buyers that, you know, take a look at our platform. So since we're talking about the future of books, I think that this is important because it offers a new, perhaps more effective way to sift through the slush pile. Most of our authors came to us after having been either dismissed entirely by traditional publishers, or if they were published traditionally, they had a less than inspiring experience, or felt neglected sometimes, or that they weren't able to reach their potential. So this is a good alternative, I think, for people that haven't had success in that regard. But we also have people that have had a lot of success and they see the value in this model. So I think that in the future there will be more room for these new sort of indie presses, non-traditional models, to seize the space around inclusion and diversity in storytelling because there's a market for it.
Right.
So I guess just with the author part, the core idea behind Inkshares has always been to measure initial engagement, because on the one hand, it allows us to find really incredible authors and stories at the acquisition stage, but it's also great market research for us to be able to effectively market and publicize these books and create foreign rights deals, audiobook deals, TV and film. And I'm sure we'll touch on this later, but you know, we're kind of existing in an IP gold rush right now. Hollywood and the other big content providers like Amazon and Apple are buying up intellectual property at a rate that no one's ever seen before. I think just a month ago, Amazon bought the streaming rights for the sci-fi epic trilogy, The Three-Body Problem, for $1 billion. So it's a huge market.
Wow.
Everyone's looking for their Game of Thrones or their Stranger Things. And audience-vetted books can offer the leanest way to test a story and see if it connects to an audience.
Right. Let's definitely put a pause on that one, just because I think it's a huge question and might be one that might be one that we can talk about in the audience Q&A in terms of people's interest too. And that always comes up, film deals and IP and all of that. So perfect. Thank you. And let's see. I have one more question for all the panelists, and then we're going to leave plenty of room for Q&A because I think we have an interested and engaged audience here. So Emily, I was struck by your bio. It says you're a beloved senior editor, and I wanted to know about how one becomes a beloved editor, and about FSG Originals, specifically why there's value in cultivating titles that defy categorization.
The funny thing is, you supply your own bio. I did not supply that one.
Oh, okay. I just decided you were beloved.
I don't know. I mean, it's very nice. I'm kind of a jerk, so it's not really accurate. No, I think I always provide like a really slim bio, and I think somebody probably just tried to beef it up, and they're like, beloved.
Maybe. I do live in California and work remotely, and so that may indicate that like they like me enough to let me do that. So, but I don't know about beloved. But I love FSG. It's been a really fun place to experiment. And with the FSG Originals, which is a paperback original line that I started with my boss Sean McDonald, we've had a lot of fun. And we can kind of push at the edges of what FSG is sort of traditionally known for. And you know, in the same spirit. But you know, I publish a lot of younger writers at debuts, that's what interests me. I mean, as an editor at a trade house, like if you don't know what you like and know how to like hold on to that with dear life, it's pretty easy for your list to become dissolved and unidentifiable, and so I just kind of chase the thrill of reading something new that I've never seen before, and that always like the prose has to be incredibly strong and interesting, and so that's kind of the
it seems to me. I mean, I know because I go to sales conferences, and they always, the sales team always wants you to put things in a category. You know, the industry is very interested in your bisect categories and the categorization. Right. So when I saw this, you know, I'm like, defy categorization. I mean, is that really more around the writing and the experimental writing that you're seeing? I mean, this is like within a genre then. It's not that you're doing crazy outside the box stuff that maybe crosses categories.
Yeah, I mean, some of it, yes. All you know, literary fiction and narrative nonfiction. Some of it's pretty crazy. I mean, I published like a couple flash fiction collections. I mean, it's not that crazy, but the cool thing about publishing in paperback original is that you can take more risks. The price point is lower, so readers who have never heard of this person before, you know, are more willing to buy it at the bookstore. And if a book does well in paperback, it can do really well. If it takes off, it can take off in a major way because people are more willing to spend $14 than $28. Did that
answer your question? Yeah, no, that's helpful. Thank you. Perfect. Well, Elaine, so we already talked about this small press question. And I mean, one of the things that strikes me about, well, tell me, how many years have you been in the industry total? Like, how long have you been over there? 31 years, yeah. So you're someone who's lived through a sea change in publishing. I mean, I've been in it 20 years, and I feel like I've lived through a lot from the time I started until now. And so with someone who has that long-range perspective, what do you see as the most challenging thing a press like City Lights faces? And if you want to extrapolate that into, you know, publishing in general, I certainly would love to hear your thoughts.
Don't get me started about, you know.
Top five.
I think the hardest thing, I mean, obviously technology has changed everything about everybody's life, and communication, books are part of how we communicate ideas to each other. I mean, even creative writing is a mode of doing that as well. And obviously, the competition with other forms of communication, which sometimes are called IP, I guess, is, you know, that's one thing. And the ways in which the technology makes those forms of communication available to us is another thing. You know, publishing books, there's a couple aspects of publishing books. The one that we like to talk about is the one that we like to think about, which is the discovery of wonderful writing and getting it into a book and choosing that and, you know, getting it into a reader's hands, blah, blah, blah. But the mechanics of that, what it takes to actually print a book and ship a book and get it into a bookstore and get all that stuff, that's a mechanical, physical, real-world project of doing business that is analogous to other products that have to come to market in some ways, and in other ways, not at all. And in our industry, of course, there is a big, huge, horrible, disgusting elephant in this room named Amazon that, you know, has trampled over a lot of things and changed everything and makes it much more fiscally difficult, if not also physically difficult, to do the kind of work that you need to do in order to publish books in any way that is at all traditional. So that is the hardest thing, I think, that the entire publishing world faces, is the domination of the readership marketplace, dollars and cents spent on reading by one vendor, who also manipulates pretty much everything else that people buy, and so it's hard to extract that anymore. And that also has influenced people's idea of what to expect from books and what the experience of reading is meant to be, because the sense of immediacy, and I'm going to have that delivered to my house today, means like also, well, why would that book ever stop being available for 1 second, you know? And why can't I have it immediately? And if this event has happened, why wouldn't there be a book in 5 months or 2 weeks or whatever? So all of these kinds of changes that have happened societally are challenges for publishers to face, because there is, in addition to the art of what we do and the mission and the passion and the societal function that we fulfill, there's also a marketplace, and that is driven by every penny you spend and how you spend it.
Thank you. Okay, Avalon, specific to this non-traditional space that that Inkshares occupies, what is the number one challenge that authors who publish on this model face?
So I think on one hand, being a non-traditional publisher and an author who publishes non-traditionally, you have to do a lot of legwork, at least in the early stages, to educate people, whether it's readers or booksellers, book buyers, the press, about the model and why it's important and why you made that choice, and what it offers to the publishing ecosystem that previously wasn't served. But I actually think that once you, when you focus on publishing really amazing books, just very high quality books, they kind of speak for themselves and they help reinforce those models and that author. So I think truly the biggest challenge is lack of financial resources if you're an indie press of any kind, non-traditional or traditional. Same goes for the author. You just don't have the deep pockets that the big five do to throw sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars at marketing and publicity budgets. So we have to be really...
We don't have that kind of money anymore.
Otherwise, yeah. Well,
maybe for the books, top 1%.
Right? Yeah. For a few books, yeah.
And other publishers, too.
Yeah,
FSG
for sure.
Is
yeah.
Different.
So it has to come elsewhere. Like, you have to... For us, we just have to be even more effective at filtering and breaking out voices by putting it in front of the right people at the right time is essentially what ends up happening.
Okay, good. I think more on that from authors in the room when we get to audience Q&A. So, Niels, what is, in your opinion, the most important contribution that university or academic presses are making in today's publishing climate?
Sure. I think this is getting more and more important, is that with the increasing accusations of fake news, whether they're real or not, because there are real news is being cast as fake news and vice versa. And because of the prevalence of the internet and the sort of information that's available everywhere on the internet, as well as sometimes corporate sort of search for dollars rather than kind of truth, it's very hard for readers to know what to trust anymore. I think university presses provide a place where you can trust the books. We have the only thing that is common amongst university presses is that we have to peer review every book that we publish, and it has to go through a faculty board. We can publish trade books, we can publish all sorts of different types of books, but they have to be approved, not just by the sort of whims of the editor or me, but by a pretty thorough vetting process. So they contribute to kind of new knowledge, but it's also verifiable knowledge in an age where there's increasing fake news and it's very difficult to know what to trust. And I think that gives us three things that are really important. One is the trust. Two is it gives us academic freedom. I've been under attack for some books that I published, some political books that some people haven't liked. There have been a lot of pressure sometimes from lawyers to like stop a book to getting published before it's published. Alan Dershowitz like attacked one of the books I published. He launched a legal and sort of public media campaign against the press. But we were able to say this has been vetted by scholars. This is an issue of academic freedom. And this was when a lot of press publishers in New York had considered the same book and wanted to publish it and decided not to publish it because of the pressures put on them. So that's a sort of strength of university publishing that's also important when there are increasing kind of conglomerate pressures to silence some voices. The third thing I think is that we publish for the present and for the future. I think part of this sort of building of knowledge that the university presses do, we keep an eye, we have to sell books. I'm doing a book on Black Lives Matter, I'm doing a book. You know, these are books that very much speak to the present, but they're also books that will be in university libraries and will stay in print for a long time and may find new audiences decades after they're published. So we're sort of keeping an eye on building knowledge for the future as well as sort of speaking to the present.
That's great, thank you. Okay, so I did prepare some questions that were for all of you, and I think that this is a fun way to spark some ideas in the audience, but we're going to call it the sprint round because everyone is going to answer these questions, but we're not going to go into depth. But I appreciate that Elaine brought up Amazon. I also wrote down that it is the elephant in the room. So limiting yourselves to a single sentence each, how would you sum up your feelings toward Amazon? Avalon. Avalon has to start.
So
she already told me yesterday at lunch.
As a customer or as
no,
a
no,
publisher?
No, as a publisher.
You can't separate those.
It's really tricky. For us, Amazon is our biggest customer. And
one sentence.
Yeah, that's it.
It's ours too, by a long way. There has been a resurgence of independent bookstores. There's been 750 new independent bookstores in the country in the last 7 years, mm-hmm. after a steep decline because of Barnes and Noble. And I do think Amazon is the evil empire, but it.
Okay, that was your sentence.
There has a resurgence of bookstores as a result.
Yeah. Amazon is the evil empire. Okay, Emily.
No, I hate them, but they sell the most books, you know?
Right.
I hate them.
Have you had enough time to think, Elaine?
Jeff Bezos is not here to help the world be a better place. He wants to live on Mars, okay? You don't want to live on Mars. You want to live here. No. Amazon is the devil. It's the devil.
Okay, so that sums up how bookstore owners feel about Amazon.
And publishers, we're publishers.
Yes, especially when they have a publishing arm. So the next question, also a sprint round. Do you feel optimistic or pessimistic about publishing's future and why?
One sentence?
It's a yes or no question followed by an answer that is limited to a short answer, 30 seconds. Lightning round.
I guess, okay. Yes, optimistic, because this idea of flat sales in traditional markets, I think, is even more of an indication of the need for new blood in the publishing industry, and this is absolutely happening, and there is more room still, and there is the energy for it.
All right. Perfect.
The answer is yes and no, but I'll say yes, because for us, knowledge is more discoverable now than ever before. And we're doing open access publishing as well, which is completely free to anybody with a computer anywhere in the world. And we're trying different business models to support that. And so my optimism for the future is that is accessible and democratic in certain new ways.
Optimistic because of full rooms like this. I do a lot of these things, and they're almost always full, and there are a lot of readers and writers out there, so glad you guys are here.
Yeah, I say optimistic as well, because in the time that I've been doing this, I've heard the voice of doom many times and faced it through many a sleepless night, and it's never happened yet, and I don't believe it will, because I see evidence of avid readers every single day.
And the people who are like, isn't print dead, are people who never it's read not. Anyway. They're like, I'm like,
yeah,
for you, it's yes. So sorry, I don't know that I can change that for you.
Okay, the final lightning round. If you look forward 5 or 10 years, we'll take the long view here, what is a single prediction you might make about the state of this industry? And then we're going to open up to Q&A, so everybody get your questions ready. Avalon, Elaine is looking at you again.
Oh, I'm sitting here. I have to start first. Sorry, one prediction?
One prediction. And yeah, and it can be positive or negative or neutral.
I think more imprints run by people of color and trans people and women, et cetera.
Nice.
I think there will be a lot of change. There will be more small imprints, but there'll also be the closure of a lot of very small university presses. So the landscape will change dramatically, and publishers that can like publishers run by trans people, people of color, or that can speak, that build their own communities like your publisher does, and speaks directly to them, will probably grow.
Sorry, what was it?
One prediction.
Just about publishing in general, the future.
Yeah, but it has to be, you know, down 5 or 10 years from now.
It might be a little sooner than that, but I think that audio is going to be like a lot of the market.
Mm-hmm. I second that.
It's already trending that way. It's wild. You know, a lot of people are like, I read that book. I'm like, you listen to that book. It's okay. I'm glad you bought
the
audio
book. Does it count?
I don't know. I would never say that.
It, but why?
No stigma. Okay. Just different things, different acts of getting information, right?
Different ways of consuming.
But the fact that people say that so freely indicates that like it's a lot of people are doing it.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't have predictions. I mean, I have hopes. I think some of the things that have been talked about are hopes. So I will say I hope that the prediction is true, that more translation is going to continue to be published. There's a real upsurge in the number of publishing houses devoting themselves to translating work from other countries into English. It's been the reverse for so long that English language writing has flooded the world. And then the majority of what has been published in translation is from a handful of European countries mainly. So there is a big flowering of work in translation of all genres. And I think that in the kind of world we live in today, it makes sense that people are interested. So I find that to also be a moment of hope, too.
Cool. I think we can agree. There's a lot to be pessimistic about, a lot to be hopeful about, and this is a wild ride of an industry to be a part of. And so thank you again, all of you, for your interest in this topic. And we have a mic runner, and we're going to take Q&A for the next 30 or so minutes. While we're waiting for that mic, Suzanne, if you're here, you bought my book. Thank you. And I have your signature. Is that you? No, you're holding your... Are you here, Suzanne? Yes, there you are. Thank you. Come and get it at the end. Like, where are you?
And those with questions, please move to the aisles.
That's going to severely limit the questioners.
Yes. I wrote my question down.
Raise your hand high.
What percentage of your books are electronic books in digital format, and who are your second biggest customers? Not Amazon, but your next largest.
Oh, the next largest retail buyer.
Yes.
Maybe a couple of you could take. So the first question, sorry, what was the first part of the question?
What percentage of your books are electronic books?
Okay.
Yeah. And
so a percentage of electronic books, and then who else do we sell to besides Amazon?
We publish every... I think this is the last one. We publish everything as a print book and an e-book, but so everything is available however anybody wants to consume it. We only have about 7 to 10% of our sales are e-book. Most people are reading print.
Anybody else with higher percentages of e-books? 7 to 10%, pretty common. Yeah.
It's higher than 7 to 10 for FSG, but it's not. It's definitely not like the majority. I mean, I think, and it depends upon the book. For fiction, much higher percentage of print reading. Nonfiction, also, like bigger nonfiction books, a lot of people want to like reference and go back and forth. For mass market fiction, it's a lot higher. I mean, sales across the board are a lot higher digital. But for FSG, I don't know exactly what it is, but I want to say something like in the like 20-25%.
And for genre fiction, which I don't think that, well, I guess Inkshares does. I mean, yeah, genre fiction can get much higher percentages just because genre fiction people like to read on their e-readers, and they're very prolific readers.
We actually sell a lot in audiobook, though. Like, to your point earlier, like, sometimes we'll sell more in audiobook than we will print and ebook combined, which is kind of crazy. It kind of depends on also who is narrating the book.
Okay, that's interesting. And then, I mean, other buyers besides Amazon, I mean, obviously there's Barnes & Noble, who also returns in massive quantities.
The indies, for us.
Yeah, for FSG, yeah. Totally. I mean, most of our sales are in, and one like beautiful thing about the independent bookstores is that they can start a movement with a book and really, and then, you know, Amazon often will follow. People want the book and then they go buy it there. But I mean, I work very hard to be close with my indie reps and with indie booksellers in the Bay Area, which has been a really fun thing about moving back, because Californians buy books. It's really great.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, they hand sell books, and for FSG, it's everything.
Can I ask a follow-on question? In terms of schools or libraries or those kinds of markets, what are you seeing? Are you seeing those markets are continuing to buy your books, or is it diminishing, increasing?
What do you get the guys think? You're going to have to figure that out, Niels, because we're not going to be on the podcast. Let me see.
Oh, let me.
Do you want to use mine?
Okay. Yeah. For us, library sales have been declining dramatically over the last 20 years. But it doesn't mean that books aren't available through libraries. They've just figured out different ways. They buy our books in digital aggregate, so people can still access them from them, but they're not buying as many physical books. And that's across the board. I mean, that's every university press who used to rely on at least 1,000 library sales for every title, and now it's like 100. And then we sell. So we have to sell to broader markets. Well, my fear about Amazon, sort of piggybacking on the last question, is that people do go to indie bookstores, and Amazon relies on those people discovering the books at these independent bookstores and then going and buying them from Amazon, which is why Amazon's opening its own bookstores right now.
Right.
But they need the bookstores as marketing.
Yeah, but I just read that Amazon has like made a significant increase in their non-book merchandise at their stores, because they're not selling that many books at their stores too. They're like
basically advertising.
Yeah. They're like, we need more pencils or.
Well, and you guys should know that the bookstores, like many of our local bookstores, are making really profound efforts to get you guys books overnighted or 2-day. If you go into your local bookstore and you ask them, you know, what is your program for me wanting a book and you getting it to me? And I just don't use Amazon unless I absolutely have to, because I will have that relationship with Book Passage or Mrs. Dalloway's. And are you guys doing that kind of thing at City Lights, Elaine? Are you shipping?
City Lights is not going to get you something within a day. I mean, it's just not possible. There's human beings that have jobs that can't drop everything and get you something in a day without charging you overnight postage and all of that. I mean, that's part of reality, too. Like, that's what you're up against, too,
right.
Is that people expect it tomorrow and for free. And that's not possible for a real company that has to pay wages to people. So we're not tax subsidized, you know. Do you know how Amazon is tax subsidized? Have you heard about that? Have you heard that they pay no income tax? Have you heard about that, too? So we don't have any of those breaks. So we get them to you. Yes, we will ship you books. You can buy books online. You know, if you want to pay for overnight shipping, you can get that. For sure.
Right.
And order books too. Although we make the decision in our bookstore that we will only order books that we normally stock. We don't order just anything for somebody who walks in because that's our choice.
Gotcha. We may need to allow mics to be passed into the aisle if we could, because I don't want to limit questions just because people can't get to the aisle. Thank you.
Hi, thank you. My question is for Niels about academic publishing and independent researchers or scholars. To what extent would you do independent, I mean, your press specifically, or academic publishing presses in general, work with or be willing to work with independent, non-academic affiliated researchers or scholars? What is the kind of initial process for determining whether or not to even send something off to peer review?
I'm glad you asked that question, because yes, absolutely. We'll publish anyone. It's the work that matters, not, you know, your status or your affiliation. The only thing that's, you know, somebody who's dependent on writing for their livelihood and not doesn't have a university salary, you know, that may make it more difficult for them. Not, you know, we would still offer them a book contract, but we do keep that into consideration. If somebody doesn't have a university salary, you know, we may, and they have a book that we really want, you know, we may up the royalties or give them a bigger advance, you know, because we know they're trying to survive on this, but they're still not going to be able to survive on this. So that's the only question. But yeah, absolutely. We publish what we like to think of as translational scholarship. So that's scholarship that's written for a wider audience to make an impact. And that could be either scholars who are able to do that, or it could be writers like Rebecca Solnit who are not professors, not academics, but use research-based scholarship and bring in their own ideas and communicate that.
Thank you.
My question is also for Niels or for anyone else who can speak to it. I'm curious about the business models for open access. Is there one that seems to be working, or can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, that's a good question too, and there's a long answer. What we found is the university libraries, going back to your question, have diminished their resources to buy books, and so universities used to fund some of our publishing through library purchases, and now we want to kind of put the onus back on universities to support the publishing of some of that scholarship through open access. So the business model we have is we're trying to pressure university departments to give their faculty resources to publish their book as part of their hiring. We still have to pay, obviously, to publish books for free, but we have a business model where we subsidize them partly. Actually, libraries are subsidizing them because they're not able to buy every book. So we have big funds from UCLA, from University of Texas libraries, from a variety of libraries that help support our open access problem. And then we try and push university departments into giving grants for open access publishing. What we found, going back to the digital print question, is we publish the open access books for free on the internet. Anybody can download them, read them. We can track who downloads them, who reads them. And then we publish them also as paperback print books for about $30-something. And people still buy them. And in fact, the digital access drives more people to buy them. They start reading them online, and then they're like, okay, I need this research. So actually, even though it's completely available for free, they buy the print-on-demand paperback.
Hmm. That's great.
Thank you. My question is particularly for Niels and Elaine, but also just generally for the panel. Two things that I was hearing related to both Amazon and university press publishing were kind of like this idea of the quality of thought and this idea that like sometimes things take time but we're in this like weird, urgent place with ideas and thought and movement and society. And for me, this is tied to my work as a former K-12 educator. I've been a K-12 educator for a significant amount of time. And my question to the panel is around this idea of publishers as sort of holding the line on the quality of thought and ideas. And for me, one of the things that I saw is like just a pinpoint of a very clear space for me where I realized something had shifted was when I was reading, and I tried so hard to read a portion of 50 Shades of Grey. And I just could not. My brain refused to take in those words. So I still, with so much great, fantastic, beautiful prose out there in the world that I have worked to bring to young people, I'm sometimes astounded by the, I won't even,
yeah,
we won't say what it is, but there's something
still
there.
The question. I get what you're saying, because it's about the responsibility that publishers have to publish good material, right?
Not just good material, but I feel like there's an element in there, and I think I'm getting into it. It's just, as publishers, as people who are basically holding, because I see it in particularly in response to like this presidency and this weird thing about ideas and truth and where we are in reality right now, how publishers are basically holding the line for the quality of ideas and thought and words in society today.
I think that they can answer that. I mean, it's a tough question that you're posing, because who gets to choose what thoughts, you know, get to be disseminated into the public, and many people have different values and things that they want to publish. So it's important to remember that 50 Shades of Grey was self-published. That is a very important thing to remember. And written, you know, largely online. And I don't think Random House bothered to do any editing. You know, I think they were just like, great, let's take that. And, you know, they sold a lot. But that's, you guys, what do you think? I mean, it's a tough question. It brings up some moral judgments, I think.
I mean, you'd think I'd be a snob because I work at FSG, but I'm not. Like, I'm happy at least people are reading, you know? I mean, I have not read it. I never will. I won't even try. But, and I don't publish anything that even, like, approaches that. But I don't know. I mean, people like it and they want it. Like, don't keep it from them, you know? And then, but obviously we've all chosen to do work that is different than that. But, I don't know. I mean, I feel conflicted about it because it's not for me, but if a lot of people are liking it and that's getting them reading words.
I think that the word publishers, that's a word under which many, many, many activities fall. So publishers don't hold the line. Each publisher holds a line that is relevant to their function and mission, if they have one. Some are not necessarily a mission. They're just whatever is going to make money, that's what I publish, and that's success. And that's a mission. That's a way of doing it. And that's as valid as anything else. I mean, books are not sacred. Books can be sacred, you know, like not like Bibles and stuff, but, you know, I mean, they can become sacred to us, and they can open all kinds of doors that are very positive. And books can also be incredibly damaging and open terrible Pandora's boxes of human tendencies. So I don't think books or publishing are necessarily crusading acts. But some people who produce books do think of books as tools in the way that I think you're trying to talk about them, and also as possible damage in the way that you're trying to talk about them, and drawing a line and saying, well, this is what I want to contribute, therefore this is what I will publish, this is what I won't publish. This might be an interesting book, but I don't find it stimulating enough prosaically to merit publishing. All those kinds of questions definitely come to play about what is quality, what is good content, all of that stuff. And so a publisher like mine you know, there are very specific, there is a sense of, you know, we draw the line here, but we're drawing the line for our readers, like other readers who don't even care about our books or ever want to read a City Lights book or, and, you know, and that's fine. So that's what I would say.
I couldn't agree more with what Elaine said. I think in terms of holding the line too, there can be pressure to publish books fast. It's a long-term industry in the sense of the fastest time you can really take to publish a book is usually like 9 months because you have to give plenty of lead time to the booksellers. But I think in terms of like developmental editorial, sometimes that can take 2 years to really get to where you want with the book. So I think publishers who don't maybe give in to that pressure to publish a book, 9-12 months out and actually take the time with it if they're able to afford that to themselves, I think that that's a way to also ensure more quality in the books.
Yeah, and I just wanted to do a quick follow-up while we decide the next person who wants to speak, which is just because I said that 50 Shades of Grey is self-published. You know, I am a huge advocate of self-publishing and want to just qualify that, you know, if you do self-publish, you actually do have a high responsibility on your shoulders to publish well. And so 50 Shades of Grey, I think, was one of those self-published books that was not well-edited, particularly poorly written. And then I think it is actually quite sad that Random House then decided to do almost no editorial development and then to put it out to a massive, massive market. But to the larger point, to Emily's point, maybe there's a readership for it, you know, but it's also erotica. You know, it's not something that we're like trying to hold as a high bar of literature. So yeah. There's all kinds of books out there and, you know, comic novels, and, you know, some of them are very political and important and some of them are just silly. And, you know, there, I think there's room for all kinds of books. So
can I just piggyback one little thing, which is sort of tangential to what you asked, but I think sort of there a little bit. One of the problems with the publishing industry is it's very white, and there are not many minority publishers in senior positions, and it is something that, you know, in terms of what is published and whose voices are heard. I mean, I like to think we're all open to all of those voices, all voices, but it hopefully that will change. And I think that's an important part of what gets published in the future.
Absolutely.
Can I say just one more thing on that? Sorry. I think one thing that a lot of readers don't necessarily know is that the sales from that book are the reason that so many of the other books that you love are able to be published. So that, like, most of the books I publish, well, a lot of the books I publish, they don't earn out their advances. So we offer writers what we think the market, like what we think we can make back, but it 9 times out of 10 it doesn't happen. Those kinds of books bankroll the good books, and that's, I mean, there's a huge problem with the model, but that's what it currently is. And so I'm sometimes really jealous that we don't have a cash cow like 50 Shades of Grey. We don't publish anything like that, so I'm unable to offer, you know, bigger advances, and I'm not always able to compete with some of the people who do have that, and then I'm like, they're not going to publish them well. We would publish them well, but at least they can pay the writers, like, you know, more. So it's complicated.
Yeah, complicated. Okay, tons of hands up if we can.
So from a writer's point of view and trying to get a book published, and there's various options, so forth, in doing research, it seems like there, and I don't know if this is still the case, this what my question is, a stigma for people who publish maybe, say, like with the more, like the hybrid or something like that, where there's a vanity sense attached to it. And so how does a writer think about that when they're looking for options? And
just hearing about it today, and there's like two parallel things going on in my head, so indulge me for just a second. One is, wow, that's so cool that there's this platform and that the possibilities for what it, for the different kinds of writers who might emerge out of that because of audience, mm-hmm. like liking them or however mm-hmm. one wants to put it in this day and age of social media. And then there's this other, and it probably betrays my generation, but also there's a kind of a snobbiness, like, but wait, what about someone picking the best book, or that idea that there's an editor or there's a I guess it kind of speaks a little bit to that woman's question over there. But I'm curious how you think, obviously it's your company, but I'm curious how you think about those two things, whether you think about them in opposition or how you've come to resolve them. Clearly you're working with that a little bit with this new way of picking, but I'm just curious about hearing more about that.
Absolutely. And that's something we think about on a day-to-day basis and talk about in our company. Thankfully, though, I mean, in the beginning, we were definitely worried about quality because you could essentially have someone come in and have all their friends buy up a bunch of copies. But those were some of the early mistakes we made, and we had to shift our model and adjust for that so that we're still finding the best stories for, you know, what we can with what we find on our platform. And we also do a lot of, I mean, we encourage people to come on to InkShares. Like, we do scouting ourselves, too. And we work with agents, too. But the model's important to us because, I mean, there are so many editors and acquisition editors and, you know, who are going to do a great job of that. And InkShares is... we offer something different because I think it's really important. We're about democratizing publishing, but we put so much work into the books that we publish. We only publish about, at most, 20 books a year. So the amount of time and resources that we do put towards developing these books is really what I think makes them more outstanding. And it's still a great indicator to the market and to booksellers. Like, when we have our sales reps go to Barnes & Noble and pitch our books, they love that 1,000 people already pre-ordered it. Mm-hmm. So I totally agree with that. It's there can be not very great books that do make the cut, but we have to then do what we can to make them exceptional. And sometimes that's completely changing the story.
It's kind of interesting, though, because what you're talking about is readers as gatekeepers. Yeah. And I think that, you know, the traditional model has always been a single acquisitions editor. And, like, yes, these people have been the arbiters of taste. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're good at what we do, right? I mean, I was an acquisitions editor for a long time. Well, Emily is beloved and may be good at what she does. But, you know, I think it's a nice shift to think that, you know, you could be proven by readers. Yeah. So it's a great question.
The readers deserve that.
Right.
It's not a shift. It's shifting the timing of it.
Yeah. Okay, you know, right, right.
Exactly. Because books are always proven
absolutely,
by readers.
Absolutely, yes, after the fact, right. Yeah. Proving the taste of the editors, I guess, in that sense.
No, not really. It's proving, like, that you actually have a nose for what it is that people expect from you and want from you. And then when you actually sell it, you figure out, oh, they do want that. And when you don't sell it, like, oh, I thought I understood who they are. Well, I guess I don't. But also, I mean, I do think that your concern is valid, though. And you can't really sugarcoat the idea that what people want is not necessarily the best. So... I'm sorry, you know, and that's not a snotty thing to say. Like, anybody who's raised a child knows that. So that doesn't mean I know what's best for you, though, you know. So I know what's best in a context of readers and authors and a sort of, you know, we're always talking about the word community, but it actually does exist. And so I think that that's what I know how to do, and it's not like I'm some snotty gatekeeper who's keeping other people away from you. And if you don't like what I publish, you won't read it either, and I won't be able to do it anymore. Just like Avalon, only she puts that cart before the horse, which is a new and interesting way of doing it. And to your question about a stigma attached to self-publishing, I think that it's not a stigma. That's a word that I wouldn't use. I would say that a track record of self-publishing is the same as not publishing for a publisher, because we're going to look at, like, if you came to me and you said, I paid and I published this book, I'd say, okay, well, good for you, and I'm glad you found a way to do it. If you come to me and you say, I published this book and I sold 1,000 copies of them myself, well, then you've actually done something with that platform, but you don't have to. And I'm not going to hold it against you that you published it yourself already, as long as you still have the rights to it and I could publish it if I wanted to. But it hasn't proven anything to me yet, any more than if you just came to me with your manuscript and said, I love my book and I wish you would publish it. So I don't think that it's a stigma. I think it's only a stigma when you're trying to use that platform as a justification for why you're good, you know, and worthy. Because anybody who has the money now can publish a book. So that doesn't mean anything, good or bad, you know, good or bad, I don't think. So it's interesting the way that, you know, these things can be turned around and used to your favor, too.
I think sometimes self-publishers don't realize that they're the ones creating the stigma, though, because they have done something inappropriate. You know, they have done something that tips off that this was not a professionally published book, and that's where the stigma is. You know, it's not inherent to self-publishing. It's the act of doing something outside the bounds of what makes a professional book look good. Because I have experienced stigma in working with self-published authors, but largely, I mean, I can tell them why. You know, you messed up. There's no running heads. The cover looks awful. You know, whatever it is that someone picks up and is just like, oh, I don't like this book. You know, so it's both and, I think. But that's a really good point.
Okay, I hear you talk about finding the best stories and scouting, and you are all publishers, and I wondered if you had written a book, like a children's book on something, and you felt it was the best quality, and you had an amazing illustrator from Japan, who was artist, phenomenal, and I'm leaving tomorrow for Japan, but with this phenomenal, good quality, best book, I've been working, I have it, and it's written, and I've been looking for an agent and a publisher, so if you had written this wonderful book, how would you start to find the right publisher? I'm totally lost on that.
Wait, who wants to take that, Emily or Elaine?
I have an answer for that one. It's a very basic answer, so it's probably not going to satisfy you. But and I don't publish kids' books, so I don't have that particular knowledge. But I will say that I tell every single author the same thing, is like, look at the books that you think are like yours, even though they're never going to be as good, and that Japanese illustrator you have is way better than anybody else. But, I mean, look at the books that are like yours. Look who's publishing them.
How do you get into that publisher? I've been doing that. I mean, how do you get that step?
Maybe go to a writer's conference. I mean, then you can talk to people face-to-face, or, you know, it is hard to penetrate those, you know, those barriers.
I want to sort of show it and say, look, well, and I'm afraid to self-publish it because I think it's that good. I don't want to just do that.
Well, there's also the you know, for kids' books, again, I don't think any of us are kids' book people, but that's a whole special marketplace, and so there are houses and editors and all of that that function within that world, and there are agents that function within that world and know who the editors are and where to place books, and so it's a matter of, like, also finding out who's the right agent for your work, because some publishing in children's book literature is done by smaller independent houses. Those kinds of publishing houses are always easier for an individual author to try to pitch. That can be difficult too, but agents are not necessary. But for a big house, you'd absolutely have to go through an agent. That's your gate. That's the one who opens the door, and also who knows who to sell it to. So and then to that effect, like, where you find agents, probably, yes, by a community of other writers who are doing the kind of work that you do, and then talk to them about who are the agents and who knows. Because you'll get that information. I mean, there are resource books for that, too, I think. There used to be listings of who's doing what in the industry.
That still exists, I hope.
Agencies will list their authors. So if you see the authors of the books that are like yours, and then you need to scout around online to find who their agent is. But big agencies will have lists of the authors that they represent, and that might be a good place to go.
I would put a quick plug in for coaches, too. You know, there are children-specific writing coaches and people who evaluate manuscripts. You know, a lot of you might do well to get your work evaluated before you approach an agent or an editor just to see, you know, am I doing this right or what red flags might be presenting. So I have a great children's book coach that I know who's local in San Francisco. I can give you her name. So I think we are, you guys, there's so many hands up and it's amazing, but we're out of time. I am going to be, there are books for sale out there if anybody is interested in Greenlight Your Book. Does anyone on the panel have a book that they're selling? Oh man, well buy all of their books from their imprints, please. Check out what they're doing and thank you to the panel.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.